This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Biofuels are not here to save the planet, they're here to save the fossil fuel industry.
Pump it all up, call it natural, wouldn't hurt a fly if we fill the sky.
Would I tell a lie, would I hide the dog?
Attention.
Big money rolling in, buy out every sin out there in the dark.
Everybody pushing biofuels to save the climate. Guest Kian Delaney from the European NGO Hub T&E finds these green alternatives could be worse than the fossil fuels they replace. With extreme wildfires, heat waves, and hurricanes, author and researcher Susanna Fisher on her new book, Sink or Swim, How the World Needs to Adapt to a Changing Climate. Hard choices this week on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Ethanol mixed with gas in every fill-up, biodiesel schemes, giant wood-powered electricity stations. Is it green? Let's get to our first interview.
Radio EcoShock.
As climate disasters ramp up, big powers and agencies push for more biofuels as a green answer. But does the math of emission savings hold up? What if biofuels are a mistake, leading to even more emissions and warming? Our guest, Kian Delaney, brings the latest. Kian is campaign coordinator on energy for the European Federation of NGOs called T&E, Transport and Environment. From Brussels, Kian Delaney, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me. Yeah, delighted to be here.
Why did your group, Transport and Environment, release a new briefing on biofuels emissions in October?
Yeah, so we've essentially published a new study very recently. We've been working on biofuels for many years now. We mainly have had like the European perspective on it, as we are based in Brussels. However, recent trends in biofuels and, you know, more of a global push for increasing biofuels production and consumption, we realized that we needed to broaden our scope beyond Europe. So our latest briefing actually looks at biofuel supply and demand and policy drivers from around the world, rather than having just this European focus. So it's kind of a first of its kind study, certainly from our organization.
Just to get us going, what are the major types of biofuels?
So there are several types of biofuels. You can have the more traditional kind, I guess we can call them. So that would be things like ethanol or biodiesel. And these traditional biofuels are already in most fuel stations. So if you go to the fuel pump now, you'll probably see on the nozzle that you're putting in the car, you'll probably see E10 or B7. It depends on what country you're in and what blending mandate they have. But essentially, these biofuels are already in our fuels that we're putting into our cars, into our fuel tanks. So these would be the majority of the biofuels at the moment. But now we're starting to see newer kinds, and we're starting to hear a lot more of these, and there's more marketing campaigns around newer biofuels. So these would be things like HEFA, which would be used for sustainable aviation fuel, or HVO, which is hydro-treated vegetable oil. And these are becoming more and more marketed as sustainable fuels and decarbonization pathways for our transport sector.
Every week, it seems there's a shiny new announcement about biofuels. In just one example, the Norwegian cruise ship Hurtigruten will run a climate-neutral biofuel cruise using hydro-treated vegetable oil. Are these ventures worthwhile, or is it just green window dressing while we continue to burn more fossil fuels?
It's an excellent question. I don't think it's within the environment's benefit to still run cruises. First of all, I can say that there's a host of problems beyond just the fuel usage that goes with cruises as a mode of tourism. But to address your question, are these ventures worthwhile or just green window dressing or greenwashing, I assume is the term that you're kind of leaning into there. It's important to kind of distinguish that some biofuels can indeed reduce emissions. So I wouldn't say that all biofuel usage is completely greenwashing for the moment. We've shown that in our study. You know, there are some GHG emission reductions depending on the pathway of the biofuel and the feedstock used. However, it's very important to recognize that there's many nuances to it. And one of the problems is that biofuels are very inefficient. So, for example, most of the biofuels these days are still used in road transport. So for road transport, electrification and electric cars that are powered from renewable electricity is a far more sustainable and a far more efficient way of reducing our carbon emissions. But then when we have more hard-to-abate sectors, so things like shipping and like aviation, electrification isn't really an option. And it's in within these kind of sectors that biofuels are really being presented as the viable option. However, unfortunately, much of the problems with biofuels in these sectors is the issue of scalability. So truly sustainable biofuels are quite limited in quantity. At T&E, we are adamant that first generation, so crops that are made from food and, that biofuels that are made from food and feed crops should no longer be considered renewable, and they should be phased out of renewable energy targets for transport. Truly sustainable biofuels, they are limited in quantity. So I don't really consider them as a viable option for full decarbonization. However, at the moment with markets, they are kind of being presented as the only option. The renewable e-fuels market is still within its infancy, and there's a few years to go until they become a pathway for hard-to-abate sectors.
In 2008, Timothy Surchinger released the study Use of U.S. Croplands for Biofuels Increases Greenhouse Gases Through Emissions from Land Use Change. Now, the biofuel lobby trashed it. They complained about indirect land use change impacts of biofuels, known as ILUC. What is indirect land use change, and why does that matter?
Yeah, so ILUC, indirect land use change, is essentially the crux of the matter when it comes to measuring emissions. This is where a lot of the discussions are and a lot of the controversies are regarding biofuels and policymaking. So due to global markets, competing uses, and there actually just being a limited amount of land to grow biofuels on, we have to consider that indirect emissions that result from the growing demand. So if we dedicate agricultural land use for biofuels, what was previously there, maybe it was cattle or maybe it was another kind of food crop that was there, well, then that needs to be displaced elsewhere. So often at the expense of a high carbon storage land. So the EU actually recognized this. They initially had what we have the Renewable Energy Directive here. There was this issue that was brought up by Tim Surchinger, and he brought up the issue that, you know, if we start having this increased demand for biofuels, what's going to happen to the global markets and the demand, and how can that seep into further deforestation or land use change indirectly? So the EU recognized this. They brought in a risk-based approach that involves monitoring feedstock expansion over high-carbon areas, and that's now being contested in global policymaking.
Your new briefing before COP30 is based partly on a 2024 report called Diverted Harvest, Environmental Risk from Growth in International Biofuel Demand. How does your group and those authors narrow down the uncertainties of land use changes and emissions?
So our recent study, it takes ILUC into consideration for the GHG emissions, and it does that by connecting land use and markets and using crop yields, prices, demand elasticity, and productivity potential to model scenarios and quantify emissions. It also is quite interesting to see in our study that we've taken into consideration carbon opportunity costs as an alternative approach to ILUC modeling. So first-generation biofuels are being shown to have this to be an inefficient solution, according to our report. And these are kind of the arguments that are often being not considered or being ignored when it comes to global policymaking. And that's what makes our report kind of first of its kind and cutting edge in this as well.
Inflation of food prices is a major issue in the United States and many other countries. Has biofuel production reached a point where fuel crops are competing with food crops? And if not yet, when?
But only for specific crops and places. So not yet across the whole global food system. In the United States and in some regions, biofuel production already is a significant share of the crop supply, and therefore it competes with food and feed uses. Globally, however, biofuels are an important, but not the sole or always the dominant driver of food price pressure. So roughly 90% of global biofuel production relies on food commodities, raising questions as to how the growth of the biofuel market will affect the global food supply. So in 2023, the biofuel industry consumed around 150 million tons of corn, 120 million tons of sugar cane and sugar beet. In total, that's the equivalent of 100 million bottles of vegetable oil being burned in our cars every day, meaning a fifth of all vegetable oil supply is not even being used for food. So yes, it certainly does have an impact on food, and we can say that it is competing with food crops.
Humans already use about half of habitable land on this planet for agriculture. If the biofuel boom develops, what about limits? Is there a peak human land use beyond which nature cannot continue, and are biofuels part of that problem?
I don't have a specific figure on these kind of tipping points when it comes to peak human land use and beyond which nature cannot continue. It's not really my expertise when it comes to biodiversity and the kind of outlooks on that. But I will say that biofuels are certainly part of that when we consider the amount of land that is needed to produce energy. So the example that we gave in our report is that for only 3% of the same amount of land used for biofuels, you can produce the same level of energy from solar power. So yeah, if we continue to ramp up our usage of biofuels, and that will increase pressure on land, and it could well contribute to this kind of peak human land use that you referred to.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Kian Delaney from the European NGO T&E. We are talking about whether biofuels deliver lower emissions as promised. The EU and United Kingdom say they will ramp up cellulosic biofuels. What is that? What is the plan? And is this better than other options like burning primary crops?
Cellulosic biofuels, yeah, these are generally made from things like agricultural waste. So the EU and the UK incentivize these types of advanced fuels through mechanisms like double counting is one that we use here in the EU. Now, there's an argument to say that these biofuels are better than first-generation crops. However, there's an absence of the implementation of strong criteria to ensure that crop residue harvests do not exceed what is needed to create and maintain soil health. Other things like agricultural residues, a lot of them already have a use. So if we start using these agricultural residues for biofuels, we may end up with their previous uses turning to more unsustainable options. Maybe that's palm oil or something that already has a worse impact on the environment. So there is some use there for things like cellulosic biofuels. But again, we need to be very careful that we don't kind of put all our eggs in one basket when it comes to these, because there are risks attached to them as well.
The soy trade has soared into international news since China stopped purchasing U.S. soy, at least until a trade deal. You and T&E battled to keep the European Union from accepting biofuels from soy and palm oil as green alternatives to fossil fuels. Why?
Well, palm and soy have the highest GHG emissions when ILUC is accounted for. Both of these crops have a long history of being associated with deforestation, especially in tropical environments, so South America and Southeast Asia, for example. The EU recognized this. When the EU first brought in its biofuel policy, palm oil was accepted, and then we saw this huge rush, this huge glut of palm oil entering into the EU to be turned into biofuels. And at the same time that this was happening, we started to see these devastating images of slash and burn and deforestation in Southeast Asia and displaced orangutans and biodiversity really suffering because of this demand for the oil. So the EU, to try and overturn this, they brought in what is known as the High ILUC and Delegated Act. And it's through this Delegated Act that the palm oil was no longer recognized as renewable. It was going to be phased out by 2030. many countries in Europe have already taken a head start and already said that they will no longer recognize palm oil as renewable. We want the same to happen for soy as well. Soy is actually the second highest. Just after palm oil, you have soy when it comes to the risk of high iLUC. We would like to see this delegated act revised. It was supposed to be revised in 2023. It was supposed to be revised based on a report that was supposed to be finished in 2021. Neither the report has been published nor the delegated act has been revised. And that is why we push for the revision of this delegated act so that we can actually, we can see soy recognized on the same level as palm oil as no longer renewable.
T&E is over 30 years old. Your NGO won significant victories like the EU ending the sales of new combustion engine cars and vans by 2035. Are you concerned about the growth of more right-wing politics in the EU and possibly a rollback of campaigns already won?
Yes, this is a major concern at the EU at the moment. We've seen a significant growth in right-wing politics in the European Parliament and in national governments across the EU. We had what was known as the Green Wave under the previous commission. We still have the same commission president, Ursula von der Leyen, who brought in this Green Wave, part of which was the Green Deal. But now this is under attack. We are starting to see the prioritization of other things, economic interests and defense, rather than environmental and climate issues. And this is a big concern. So at the moment, we're seeing the 2035 CO2 regulation, which is essentially the 2035 internal combustion engine phase-out. We're seeing that being attacked by car manufacturers in Europe who say that this is detrimental to their industry and being supported by right-wing politics. So it's a major concern. It's a time for defending what we had. We had very progressive EU policy that was going to be effective. It's still in place, so nothing has changed as of now, yet we need to make sure that the previous progress that was made, that we don't have a backslide in the current political context here.
Well, I realize the U.S. is not your focus, but have you heard of any movement by the Trump administration to boost biofuel production or weaken rulings about its total emissions?
I believe as part of the big, beautiful bill, the tax credits for biofuels that were produced in the U.S. were allowed to remain. I'm not sure if they're to the same level, but I believe that there is still some hope there for U.S. biofuel producers. And what is quite concerning is I believe that there's also consideration for removing any reference to iLUC in U.S. policy regarding biofuels.
Also abroad in 2023, India launched the Global Biofuels Alliance to increase global use of biofuels. The alliance now counts 32 member countries, but I'm puzzled. Why are some of the largest fossil fuel producers, like the United States, Canada, and the United Arab Emirates, part of this alliance when it hopes to displace some of their products?
Well, there's a saying in the biofuels world, more the activist side of things, that biofuels are not here to save the planet, they're here to save the fossil fuel industry. And that might seem as a bit counterproductive, but we have to remember that today the majority of biofuels are still blended with fossil fuels. So when you go to the fuel station, when you go to the nozzle, it's going to be, if you're using diesel, it'll still be 93% fossil diesel, 7% biodiesel. So the idea that these will be directly competing with each other, it's not exactly true. You know, fossil fuel producers would rather be in the driving seat of the production of biofuels because it also means that internal combustion engines and their own fossil fuel products will still stay relevant, as opposed to if we start replacing those things with hydrogen or with electrification. So climate policy will still dictate a need for renewables, and biofuels offer fossil fuel companies a chance to ensure that renewable energy is still going to be achieved through combustion.
And they can call it green and put it in green pumps for us. Oh, well. So tell us about the role of increasing biofuel production in Brazil and destruction of the Amazon rainforest.
Brazil is the second largest producer of biofuels in the world. They're an absolute powerhouse when it comes to biofuels. Sugarcane ethanol and soy biodiesel are two of their key commodities. Soy, in particular, is and has been a major driver of deforestation in Brazil. things in the Amazon have improved considerably under Lula compared to his predecessor, Bolsonaro. But there is still a cause for concern. So just this year, the Brazilian Ministry for Trade suspended the soy moratorium, which is in place to protect the Amazon from deforestation from soy. And then at the same time, just ahead of the Brazilian COP presidency, Brazil has launched a bid to quadruple sustainable fuels by 2035, which is enormous. Now, as part of this quadrupling, they envision doubling the global supply of biofuels. They based this on a report from the International Energy Agency, the IEA, and hidden in the small print of this report, it does say that this doubling of biofuels should not come with more land expansion. Very small in the fine print. But as part of this pledge that they're launching to quadruple, we don't see this level of detail regarding land expansion. Furthermore, while deforestation in the Amazon may have decreased recently, there are other biomes in Brazil and in South America that are carbon sinks, so the likes of the Cerrado, which is a kind of grassland. We have also still seen soy expansion in the Cerrado. So it is still a concern. If the advice from IEA is that doubling biofuels is possible with no land expansion, we'd really like to see that in any pledge from Brazil or in any plans from Brazil or any of the countries that sign on to this pledge, we'd like to see some sort of infrastructure or monitoring kind of at the forefront of how we're going to do this. Otherwise, we risk having a very ambitious target of doubling biofuels and with no proper safeguards to make sure that doesn't result in land expansion, or then we could see a considerable amount of land use change, whether it's direct or indirect.
In your experience, who is ready to accept the true carbon cost of biofuels, and who will be on the sort of other side at COP30 to fight off criticism of the industry?
So, T&E will be there at COP. Civil society will be there. And we'll be there to make sure that the risks associated with biofuel production are given some attention. There will be, of course, criticism from the industry. We've seen it already, and we've also seen criticism from biofuel-producing countries. So recently, we had the International Maritime Organization discussing their net zero framework. In the end, these negotiations were postponed due to the U.S. essentially threatening to torpedo the whole initiative. But we do see criticism from the industry and from biofuel-producing countries against any pushback against biofuels. We also see collaborations in the forms of what you mentioned previously, the Global Biofuels Alliance and other kind of lobbying associations that are putting industry stakeholders in touch with national governments. And when I say industry stakeholders, it's usually kind of the usual suspects. So we see companies like Shell and Eni and Repsol, so these big fossil fuel companies and energy suppliers who are behind this push for biofuels.
Do you think our love affair with biofuels is based on good intentions, or is it really another industrial solution similar to what got us into this emissions trap?
We have explicitly given a subchapter in our briefing recommending world leaders do not fall into the biofuels trap. I do think that much of our love affair with biofuels is based on good intentions. They're being offered as a ready-made, mature technology to decarbonize our transport sector. However, I do think that there is a need for recognizing and for presenting that the risks that are involved with this. Whether there's nefarious industry lobbying going on, I'm sure there is, and I know there is, and a push for bioenergy as this golden solution. Maybe they're being ill-informed. Policymakers can be ill-informed on this, and that they are being used as this get-out-of-jail-free card when it comes to decarbonizing transport, rather than investing in other pathways like pure electrification for battery vehicles or for renewable hydrogen for e-fuels. Biofuels are presented as this mature industry. And you can see why a policymaker would consider this as a way or set a target for biofuels for their decarbonization efforts. You know, the path to hell is paved with good intentions, so I wouldn't say that it's all based on bad intentions, but certainly ill-informed intentions.
Well, based on your report, how much extra carbon is produced by some biofuels more than what would have happened if people had just burned fossil fuels for the same job?
So our report has taken As I mentioned, it's taken ILUC into consideration for calculating GHG emissions. We've taken the average, so we haven't just looked at biofuels as one. We have to consider the global market when it comes to biofuels. That's the kind of key issue here, because everything is connected now. So while biofuels in one country might show that there are some GHG or emissions reductions, albeit much less than electrification, you have to consider that they're also on the same market as things like palm oil from Indonesia and Malaysia. And that's where we see this massive increase in GHG emissions because of indirect land use change. We've calculated that on average, biofuel usage emits 16% more carbon than the fossil fuels that they're supposed to replace. However, you have to really consider this as a global average. And when there is emissions reductions in certain scenarios, they are very limited compared to other options. And then as well as this, when we're talking about biofuels, it's important that we don't just get stuck in the trap of looking at GHG emissions reductions as the be-all and end-all. There's lots of other factors that need to be considered. So things like intensive agriculture and monocultures, fertilizer runoff, water demand from irrigation. We calculated that to run a car on biofuels would require 3,000 liters of water per 100 kilometers traveled, which is, for fresh water, that's an incredible amount of pressure on our fresh water cycle. So these are other considerations we need to take into account when biofuels. We can't just focus only on GHG emissions reductions.
What should we do? Do we limit or ban biofuels? And if so, do we have real alternatives?
So when it comes to biofuels, we really need to make sure that there are strong safeguards in place. These can look like volume caps. So we have a volume cap here in the EU. Food and feed crop biofuels at the EU policy level, there's a 7% cap. That varies country per country, as it's based on what 2019 levels were for that country. So things like volume caps can help. I don't think we're able to ban biofuels. There's an industry there, and there's laws that allow it to exist, so that's not possible. But what we do need is strong safeguards, strong regulations, things like monitoring and evaluation to be more transparent, so supply chain transparency as well as certification transparency. These can all be improved to make sure that the environmental or climate damage that's done from biofuels is limited. I think that's the best we can kind of hope for at the moment.
From Brussels, we've been speaking with Kian Delaney, his group T&E in Brussels, and Dr. Chris Mallins at Cereology have investigated the full emissions of biofuels, finding them worse than fossil fuels they replace in some instances. Find links to the press briefing and report in my show blog at ecoshock.org and check out www.transportenvironment.org. Kian, thank you for helping us see this bigger picture.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
After extreme wildfires, heat waves, and hurricanes, we come to hard choices. Is it too late for Band-Aids and promises? According to a new book by Susanna Fisher, it is time to sink or swim. After years advising governments and the United Nations, Susanna is a principal research fellow at University College London. From the UK, Susanna Fisher, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
With the call to drastically slash greenhouse gas emissions, have we now reached a second stage? What to do now that climate change has arrived?
I don't think we've reached the second stage, but I think we're at the point where, as well as dramatically slashing greenhouse gas emissions, we also need to adapt to climate change. And I think it's really important that we still see those as two sides of the same coin. So we're reducing greenhouse gas emissions as fast as we can, but unfortunately that has not gone enough to prevent the damage to the Earth's climate. So we now need to adapt as well to keep people as safe as we possibly can from the impacts. But we also need to keep mitigating, because the more we mitigate, the less we'll need to adapt.
What do you and your colleagues mean by adaptation?
This is a great question. So when we talk about adaptation, we mean allowing people or communities or places to to better manage the risks of climate change or the impacts of climate change. So, for example, we are seeing greater heat waves across the world, more intense and more frequent. And adaptation is helping people respond to those. So that might be, for example, changing the working hours of the day so manual laborers don't have to be out in the middle of the day in burning heat. Or it might be supporting community spaces to provide cooling for people who can't afford it at home. Or it might be building flood defenses in places along the coast and are being threatened by storm surges. Or it might be putting in place early warning systems, for example, hurricanes, to help people move away as quickly as possible to find somewhere safe. So adaptation can mean many different things, depending on the types of hazards that people are facing and really how vulnerable they are. Because, you know, some people may already have the resources to manage something like extreme heat by themselves, but other people don't. And so adaptation is making sure that everyone has got the support and the capacity that they need to manage the changing climate which is coming our way.
You traveled and met with many groups in many countries, including India. Do you think there is more intense demand for adaptation in developing countries than in the West?
I think adaptation has started out as an issue that was primarily framed around developing countries, those in the global South. And I think that's partly because there are often much higher levels of poverty in some of those countries, and they're also working in sectors that are more directly exposed to the climate. So, for example, smallholder farmers just don't have much resilience if there's a drought or a flood. So I think that has been the way the issue kind of was historically thought about. But what we're increasingly seeing is that adaptation is an issue for everybody. So, you know, we've seen hurricanes hitting multiple countries. We've seen the European floods. We've seen heat waves across multiple countries. So increasingly, it's clear that adaptation is not something happening elsewhere. It's kind of happening everywhere. And almost every country that we can think of is going to need to adapt to the impacts of climate change.
Right. It's not just Bangladesh. It's downtown Los Angeles after those fires, for example. Now, in your book, Sink or Swim, you examine adaptation roles for institutions like the military and financial markets. What are the potential opportunities and risks of involving these powerful actors in shaping climate strategies?
Well, I think, you know, the military is a really interesting example because they're often a kind of a force that's available within a country. They've been used to respond for disasters, for wildfires, for flood management. And in some ways that makes sense because they're there and they're ready and they've often got the equipment that they need. But there are some really hard questions that this provokes. So, you know, one is like if we use the military in that way to respond day to day to the threats that we're facing within countries, what about if they needed for a wider defense? Will they still be ready? You know, are we taking away some of their capacity by doing these day-to-day activities? And the other is thinking about actually what is the role of the military within a country, and is it helpful, or do all countries want that, you know, the military to play that role? Because in some places the military may be a benign force, in others they may be particularly aligned with a political group, and they may marginalize others, and it's a very particular type of disaster risk management which comes with the military, which is obviously just aligned with the way that they work. So I think whilst some of those new actors do kind of give us capacity and resource and ways of managing the threats, I think it's also really important to stop and think, what are the implications of using those types of actor? And I think the private sector and finance is another really interesting example, that increasingly adaptation is kind of interwoven with financial mechanisms of ways of kind of managing risk. And whilst that can really work in some scenarios, insurance has often really helped people, you know, manage their risk. In some cases, it also leaves people out, people who can't be insured, for example, or can't find a financial market for their risk. It risks not really always paying out. So I think there's some risk to what we call the financialization of adaptation, which is making it all about the money, because a lot of it is also about how people live their lives, their well-being, you know, the health and the educational outcomes, things that aren't necessarily captured when you only think about things from a financial perspective.
Among developed countries, are there any well-aimed adaptation projects or programs that stand out to you, Susanna?
Yeah, well, I think we do have some really great examples of countries managing existing climate variability that will hopefully become examples of also managing the future. So, you know, in London, where I live, we have something called the Thames Barrier, which is built to prevent flooding in central London. And it's been a big infrastructure investment. And it's also built to manage the future. So they review the research and the science every 5 to 10 years and see what they'll need to do to keep building that barrier up as we face sea level rise. And that's really a critical part of protecting London's infrastructure. Elsewhere, obviously the Netherlands have got a very long history of managing flooding and water issues and have really developed that into a national scale. So I think we do see these examples of where people and countries have taken the next step. And I think what we need to do is make sure that those positions are going to be suitable for the future, because often they were built for a past climate. And now we need to think about moving them and kind of updating them to face the ongoing risk.
And tell us about transformational adaptation. What is that?
So the idea here is, in many places, we might be able to keep going as we are. And so make small changes to the system, small changes to how we live our lives, and, you know, climate change won't affect us too much. And I would call that incremental change. So, you know, you might be able to just put on an extra jumper if it's colder, or you're fine in an extra slightly hotter temperature. It doesn't affect your life too much. But I think as we look at the way global temperatures are going, it's likely that that won't be enough in some places, that we'll actually have to make quite significant changes in how we live our lives, where we're living, where we consider to be safe. And I would call that transformational adaptation. So it's really a change in how people are living, a kind of step change away from business as usual to doing something quite different. And I think perhaps one of the easiest ways to think about that is thinking about what's been known as relocation, planned relocation. So communities who are living in low-lying coastal areas, we might think an incremental way to help them would be, for example, to give an early warning system if a flood is coming, or build a barrier. But in some of these places, that's just not going to be enough over time. And a transformational approach would be to work with them to find another place, essentially to relocate the whole community. And obviously, it's really, really hard to do those things, and people don't necessarily want to. It's hard to bear the short-term cost, and people, of course, are very attached to the places they call home. So these are very often difficult decisions to make, but they're some of the decisions that we might have to face up to as the global temperatures warm.
And experts also talk about hard and soft limits to adaptation. What does that mean?
Yeah, so that's thinking about the limit of adaptation is when you can no longer continue living as you are and you need to really do something differently. And the soft limit might be the limit that we don't at the moment have the technology, for example, to manage the changing temperatures or to grow crops in a particular area. But those limits might change over time. Or, for example, we don't have the resources to build a really large flood defense around a particular city, but that's a bit of a soft limit in that it may change over time in terms of the money that a country has or their willingness to pay for it as the floods increase. But a hard limit would be a really hard, firm limit, saying land is going to go below sea level, or this could be really unlivable, and that's really a hard physical limit where we really can't push it any further.
There are all sorts of strange new problems coming up as the climate changes. For example, in the book you ask, who has the right to moving fish? What is the issue, and is it happening already?
Yeah, so as the oceans warm, we see the patterns of some migratory fish move. As the fish want to get away from the hotter waters back to the climates that they're used to. So the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is anticipating that many of the fish will be moving away from the waters around the equator to cooler areas. And one of the things I discuss, particularly in the book, is this case in the Pacific, where they have very highly migratory species of tuna, and they have a very well-developed system for managing it. And they kind of share the catch between them, and it's highly worked out to make sure that it benefits the people living in the small islands around that area. So one of the questions I'm posing is, as these fish start to move and they move out of these management regimes that have developed over time to support the people who live there, you know, what is a fair and just way of dealing with that? If we have countries who had a natural resource which has now moved on, you know, is there a way that we can make it fair in terms of how we continue to fish? Or do we just accept that as the fish move on, usually away from countries that haven't caused the problem, off towards those who have, that those countries also benefit? So I think this is a really hard choice in terms of how do we think about a just way of dealing with these changes.
Technically, loss and damage refers to impacts from climate change that cannot be prevented by adaptation. Are there international plans to provide help after climate-driven loss and damage?
Yeah, so loss and damage is now the third pillar of climate change policy. If we think we've got mitigation, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, adapting, kind of managing the impact, and then loss and damage, what's left after we can't adapt. So the international community has put in place a fund for responding to loss and damage, with the idea that that will start to fund countries, for example, after an extreme event, or to help them commemorate things or cultures or places or language that are lost. That is being developed, but as yet there's really not enough finance going into it. So as we see in the broader international system, there has been a desire to create that loss and damage fund, but at the moment we're not seeing the significant funds going into it that would meet the scale of the loss and damage that we expect to see.
And your book cites work by Siri Erickson and Lisa Schipper finding some adaptation strategies actually make things worse. Tell us about maladaptation, and can you give us an example?
Yeah, so the idea of maladaptation is that whilst people or a donor agency or government might implement a project trying to help people manage the risks of climate change, in fact, in some situations, this can either make things worse for that particular community. If, for example, maybe the project didn't take into account longer-term climate trends. So it might, for example, support people to use a new irrigation technology in a particular area, but actually as water declines, irrigation isn't a feasible strategy anymore. So that would be maladaptation because people have not actually been helped to become more resilient. Or another form of maladaptation would be when, for example, you might help one community living on a coastline to manage erosion and flooding through kind of building up defences, and that might actually just shift the risk down the coast to the next community where the water would instead be diverted, perhaps with even greater power. So by making one community more resilient, you're actually making another one worse off. So it's quite difficult to manage this, but of course, in some ways, it's not new that policies or programmes have unintended consequences. So the important thing is really to think through these questions in advance. So what are the longer-term risks? You know, how might we manage them? How will this project deliver over time? And also, how will managing this risk for this particular group of people in this place, how will that spill over to others who are facing similar situations? I mean, adaptation is not perfect, and that's kind of part of my book to say that everyone is trying their best. But there are inevitable unintended consequences or things that we're learning because it was a new agenda, really. So we are learning how to adapt, and we need to learn quickly because the climate impacts are escalating quickly.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Susanna Fisher, author of the new book Sink or Swim, How the World Needs to Adapt to a Changing Climate. The strongest Atlantic hurricane ever to hit land just arrived on the western end of Jamaica, the less developed region there. And 20 years ago, another hurricane flooded the poorest part of New Orleans. Talk to us about vulnerable people with, as you say in the book, long histories of structural exclusion.
One of the realities of the way that climate risks are hitting people is they are, of course, hitting existing structures within society. So people who are already vulnerable just because of economic exclusion or long structural histories of colonialism or other factors are often more in harm's way. And this is the kind of history of vulnerability, and we see that playing out now across multiple locations. And of course, it really strengthens the argument around climate justice because people who are often at the forefront of experiencing these impacts are really not those who've caused it and those who've already experienced many other situations of inequality. So it's something we need to really work on and also suggest how adaptation is not just about addressing additional climate risk, but also thinking about how to manage those existing structural inequalities that make people be at risk in the first place.
We may have created events and conditions so damaging that there will be no restitution here or abroad. What if we've done more damage to nature than anyone can pay for? What do you think?
Well, I guess the question is more than we can pay for is an interesting way of framing it. I mean, the costs of adaptation are really high, and there's a massive gap in terms of the money that's needed and the money that's been provided internationally, but also the money that developed countries are putting into their own adaptation. We're only really putting in a fraction of what's needed. So there is a huge financial gap, but I think it's about money, but it's also about more than money. It's about the fact that we're even now still building in floodplains, for example. We are continuing to increase our own risk at the same time as we can see that the cost of managing the risk is getting higher and higher. So on the face of it, there's more than we can currently manage because we haven't put enough finance into it, but we're also continuing to conduct our economies in business as usual, which is ramping up our risk. So I think it's two sides of the coin, and we can seek more investment through a variety of strategies, but we also need to change how we're managing risk.
You say conflict does not necessarily lead to violence or war. Congressman John Lewis talked about good trouble. Is there good conflict?
Well, I think conflict can be a way of surfacing disagreement between people and between countries. And I think it's often important to have those issues worked through a negotiated process or through something that allows people or countries to feel heard. Because otherwise, it can really escalate. And if people don't feel that their views are included or countries don't have a voice in a multilateral process, for example, that can lead to resentment and all kinds of other consequences. So, yes, I think there can be cases when conflict can be almost a transformative force that allows people to develop new solutions together. But obviously, the key is to avoid it descending into violence and war, which is what we do see in some circumstances.
As a global problem, climate action needs cooperation of all people and countries. But as we speak, and as you mentioned in the book, armed conflicts continue in many parts of the world. Do we have to wait for world peace, or can we start eliminating adaptation and getting it going despite war?
Yeah, I think this is a really tricky issue and one that many working on adaptation have struggled with, because many of the most climate vulnerable places in the world are also what might be called fragile and conflict-afflicted states. But the people living in those places are really vulnerable to climate change. But until now, donors and multilateral organizations have struggled with how to get money to those places when the governments and the institutions are so fragile. And I'm quite pragmatic on this, and I think we can't wait for perfect conditions because we're not going to get there. And so we need to think about how to get money into these places. And there have been, you know, some good examples of targeting individuals, for example, through cash payments or working through unusual actors in these spaces like faith-based groups. So I think there are ways to work around it. And I think, you know, as you say, we have to give up the idea of there being a perfect scenario. We have to do adaptation in the places that need it now.
And into this mix of wildly different human societies, now with a massive common problem, we toss in early-stage artificial intelligence. So how does AI change the story, or does it?
I mean, I think AI is one of many trends that are slightly shaping the world right now. And obviously, one of the key concerns has been about data usage and then kind of increasing energy supplies. But I think from the context of adaptation, for me, it's still the core issues that there are the changing trends in the world, and maybe that technology will help us in the future. But right now, I think we're still facing those same old issues of how to manage the climate impacts.
America's climate policy is whatever the president posts today. Canada makes lots of green promises and then builds even more fossil fuel production. What if there are really no policymakers? Maybe it's just the rest of us. What then?
I think we have to look to people who are leading the way, and they might not always be the politicians or the policymakers that we expect. And I think that we do see, you know, some countries leading the way on the energy transition, and we also see individuals taking the stance to make change that's needed. But you're right that we often see either countries or governments, you know, saying that they support climate action but still subsidizing fossil fuels, or in the case of some right now, just really not committing to the multilateral process at all. And I think in those situations, as I said, we've got to look for where we can find leadership and build behind those people and places, because we're at such a critical moment in history right now that we can't wait to get everybody back on board. We have to look for who's moving fast and go with them and try and build a coalition that can take the climate action that we need.
With your new book out, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm still working on my academic work, which looks at how we finance some of these adaptation projects. And I'm also thinking about my next step. So I'm particularly interested in what adaptation means in the UK right now. So the book I've just published is really a global picture, posing really big questions that face us globally. And now I'm really interested in taking those questions down, you know, to one particular place and thinking, like, what does this really mean for a set of communities living in this location?
We have been speaking with Susanna Fisher, Principal Research Fellow at University College London. Her new book is Sink or Swim, How the World Needs to Adapt to a Changing Climate. You can get more info and links to follow up in my weekly blog at ecoshock.org. Susanna, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Susanna Fisher's new book contends that adaptation is inseparable from climate justice and should be undertaken with communities rather than imposed upon them. In many Western minds, this raises the images of villages far away organizing themselves. Actually, this means you. We need to rein in consumption, starting with wealthy people who don't want to give up much, if anything. I think the majority of us are going to need to impose climate and justice on the 0.5% on the top of the fossil tower of power. Frankly, well-informed people think we are already heading into climate disaster. At some point, we may spend less time on planning for emission cuts in 2060, or minor cuts to help people feel they are contributing, and spend everything we've got on saving lives and livelihoods. As the title of Susanna's book suggests, it is adaptation or massive human failure, along with a cohort of other species of all size going down with us. Doomers would welcome a book that doesn't try to explain greenhouse gas reduction strategies. Again, many books and reports do this, thankfully. But an experienced voice talking about what will we do in this fast-developing new reality. This also goes to government and trust in government, doesn't it? Suppose scientists, financial experts, and government experts all agree 1 million people need to move away from their homes perched on the eastern seaboard because of extreme storms, storm surge, and rising seas. The current approach is to leave it up to homeowners, although there have been some buyout programs after major disasters, like hurricanes. For example, the U.S. FEMA has programs like the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program or Flood Mitigation Assistance. The structures purchased by the government are then demolished, and the land is rezoned as permanent open space. This is a key part of the process. The land cannot be rebuilt upon. It often converts into wetlands, dunes, or parkland to act as a natural buffer against future storms. Does FEMA still offer buyout money? Or was that slashed because of the climate hoax? One government response is to abandon people who made the mistake of building too close to a changing sea. After all, why should the rest of us pay for some millionaire who wanted front row seats to the ocean? And then they likely tried to wall that off so we can't get to the sea. It's not a good use of taxpayer money. Maybe instead governments should enforce warning labels and advertise risks. Every deed for an oceanfront property should show the risk right on it and clearly, and then the buyer has to sign it. There should be no liability for the taxpayer. In addition, as with cigarettes, government advertising could warn against building or moving into high-risk areas, whether it's closer to the sea or into fire-ready forests. All this, of course, may not work so well in Mumbai, where people must live where they must live. Susanna Fisher warns social tweaking is just not enough now. She writes, quote, Lee Barung Ford, a professor at the University of Leeds, noticed a few years ago that the global community had very little idea how adaptation to climate change was happening across the world. She brought together a team to analyze huge amounts of peer-reviewed research on adaptation, and the work published in the leading journal Nature Climate Change confirmed that adaptation so far has been small scale. It has focused on tweaking current policies and programs and has been uneven across the world, end quote. Fisher cites that paper, a systematic global stocktake of evidence on human adaptation to climate change, published October 28, 2021, in the journal Nature Climate Change. Sometimes I wonder, am I just a climate justice doomer? Think of this. Almost all governments of developed countries already carry fantastic national debts that can never be repaid. Increasing chunks of tax dollars just go to treasury investors to pay off the debt. What if nations claim there is not enough money or resources to help every climate victim? Perhaps during a recession or economic crash in the West, there will be nothing to cover the cost of moving and resettling faraway strangers. A realist citing current trends might argue, despite conferences and pledges, it is obvious that a large part of humanity will move or die without the help from developed countries. And in fact, climate refugees may be resisted by force if they try to come, by the very countries who made the most out of burning fossil fuels. Are we just kidding ourselves about adaptation planning and international funds for climate damages? The largest single international funder of aid, America, just canceled all that. Not just internationally. The Trump administration has gutted FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration. FEMA responded to disasters like hurricanes and flooding. And those are getting too large for a single state to pay for the recovery. Municipal budgets are already overloaded. Insurance companies are withdrawing from coverage or charging huge rates to discourage anyone but wealthy clients. That leaves it all to individuals, families, and local communities. That is where help in coming times will come from. All that needs to be fed and watered in advance. Get good with your family and community. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Strip off night.
Pretend away, that's right.
No need to ever look in the dark.